Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the beloved Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, good, bad, and crazy news for conservatives. And Jim, many people in the media are sad because they wanted a story out of the Scottish independence vote. But as we explained last week, that's probably a good thing given all the upheaval going on in the world, and the British government needs to have its eyes on the ball. It was expected to be a razor-thin vote on Scottish independence on Thursday. In the end, it was a little more than a 10-point margin for the no vote. So big sigh of relief from the Queen, from British Prime Minister David Cameron, and all sorts of other people who were concerned about the ramifications if Scotland had broken away. Jim, we're going to miss those Scottish accents from all the reports leading up to the vote, but there's always the British Open next year.
I will spare listeners doing the remainder of this podcast in the voice of Sean Connery. I had quite a bit of fun yesterday on Twitter. I've been told it's not too bad, young Greg. Let me tell you, I was deeply disappointed. You know whose fault the defeat of the referendum is?
Who's that?
Alex Trebek. short version, it's hard to dispute that the United Kingdom would be weaker without Scotland. I think it would be more likely to turn inward, dealing with the complications of the big separation, and less likely to be helping us with a dangerous world. And so for the interests of the United States, I think that is a good thing that they did not split up like this. I think the slogan was better together. I think one of the big reasons why the Scots ultimately turned away, despite some very close polls, was recognition that separating into your own country is a little more complicated than it looks, than it sounds like. And the idea that actually the Scottish economy by itself might not be so terrific. Oil reserves in the North Sea are not necessarily something you can build a broad, prosperous country on. You can look from anywhere in the Middle East, or even Norway having problems of its own, even with immense oil wealth over there. And just generally a recognition that this was not going somewhere. Folks that I trust, the likes of Daniel Hannan and Louise Mensch, are kind of Tory conservative thinkers, writers, in one case a member of the European Parliament, the other one a member of the UK, former member of the UK Parliament, now columnist, making the case that this was going to lead to big problems in the UK. So they stay together. And I think it's safe to say the issue is now largely resolved. Probably for another generation or so. And as Daniel Hannan pointed out, that the compromise that was going to come forward after this is that it's more likely to give a little bit more autonomy and a little bit more local control to the Scots, since they don't want full separate independence. And oh, by the way, that is a good thing, considering that's something that, at least in general, we on the right have always supported. So somebody had said, well, you know, if Scotland separated, it'd probably be a rare day before the UK ever saw a Labour prime minister again. And I could see some people doing that, but I think I'd rather have, you know, both parties having a shot at managing a united and more powerful and stronger and more secure United Kingdom than having consistent Tory control of a weaker United Kingdom. So that's where I come down on that one, Greg.
I think a lot of people agree with that. I'm just trying to imagine in my mind, given the high turnout, Sean Connery getting increasingly frustrated waiting in line. That guy's taken forever.
Oh, pretty good, Greg. All right. You know, if only we had known, we could have done the entire podcast. In dueling Sean Connery.
All right. Well, we'll see if they ever go down that road again. But that was certainly one of the entertaining aspects of the story. But I think a lot of people will agree with the serious case you just made. Speaking of the British keeping their eye on things we might need their help on, let's talk about ISIS here in the bad martini. And the president got what he wanted from the House and Senate in bipartisan fashion, really, on arming and training Syrian rebels. And that's part of the continuing resolution also, which has passed. But here's a story that broke in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, and it's been picked up by other outlets as well. This is not good. The U.S. military campaign against Islamist militants in Syria is being designed to allow President Barack Obama to exert a high degree of personal control, going so far as to require that the military obtain presidential sign-off for strikes in Syrian territory, officials said. Skip down a couple paragraphs. Defense officials said that the strikes in Syria are more likely to look like a targeted counterterrorism campaign than a classic military campaign in which a combatant commander picks targets within the parameters set by the commander-in-chief. Jim, if you liked LBJ, you're going to love this plan.
Yeah, that was exactly what came to mind when I first saw that story, Greg, that For those who aren't as familiar with not so distant history, LBJ at one point, you know, made the joke that they can't bomb an outhouse in Vietnam without my approval. General Westmoreland, who was in charge of forces over there, complained about it a great deal in his autobiography and basically said, look, we had a bunch of Harvard-educated eggheads in the White House who thought they knew how to run a war better than the professional, you know, generals and soldiers did. Doesn't sound familiar at all, right, Greg? I understand that the buck stops with President Obama, even though he may disagree with that. The president is commander-in-chief, and ultimately he will pay the political price, pay the moral price. He will pay the price in terms of political capital and authority and trust of the public if things go wrong in wartime. So I understand that he's got to be engaged with his generals, and you don't want any rogue generals or anything going that is contrary to the president's policy. Ideally, you have the pair working in tandem because, again, you want the president, you know, very much engaged but not a micromanager. And you see that story, and it just kind of felt like, boy, we were heading down something particularly dangerous. And look, and granted, you know, what targets to strike in Syria is a really sensitive matter because we're trying to fight ISIS, and we're not friends. We certainly don't like Bashar Assad, but there are enough Islamists in the Syrian rebels that we don't necessarily want to arm somebody who's even worse than Assad. We have a fight between two bad guys, and we got to try to focus on the bad guy that has threatened us, which is to say ISIS, and not, you know, Assad is one we've decided. We allegedly took away his chemical weapons, except for the chlorine gas that he keeps using against some rebels. People get this increasing suspicion we're getting, you know, dragged down into a quagmire here. I understand the president's concern, but between that and another story that came out saying that the friction between the military brass and the president and the White House staff is getting worse. And as if it wasn't enough, this morning, Greg, Jim Clapper, the director of national intelligence, said we underestimated ISIS's willingness to fight and their tenacity, the same way we underestimated the Viet Cong in Vietnam. Boy, that's unnerving, isn't it?
Great. More parallels to Vietnam. That's just
yeah. I mean, you know, when the administration's own people are saying, yeah, you know what? We went wrong. We made the same mistake as Vietnam. Points for honesty, I guess. But boy, oh boy, that doesn't make us feel any better about what's coming down the pike.
No, not at all. But if you do need a laugh or a cringe, the vice president has been happy to oblige in a week full of bad news as usual. Joe Biden, of course, is a gaffe machine, and there's a reason why they don't let him out in public too often. And this week is a perfect example. He hit for the trifecta this week, Jim. So let's go through these quotes. This one, he's talking about how his son, Bo Biden, who I believe either was or still is the attorney general in the state of Delaware, was approached after his years serving in Iraq about predatory lenders on people trying to buy houses.
When he was over there in Iraq for a year, people would come to him and talk about what was happening to them at home in terms of foreclosures, in terms of bad loans that were being, I mean, these Shylocks who took advantage of these women and men while overseas.
Shylocks, obviously Jewish folks and others who are sensitive to that term, not happy at all with that. Biden did apologize for that, but on the very same day said this.
On the way back from Mumbai to go meet with President Xi in China, I stopped in Singapore to meet with a guy named Lee Kuan Yew, who most foreign policy experts around the world say is the wisest man in the Orient.
A couple generations ago, Jim, and maybe even a generation ago, Orient was an acceptable term, but that is certainly fallen out of favor in recent years. But not to be outdone, perhaps the most amazing of the week just happened. This is so recent, it comes from a tweet by CNN's Dana Bash. I'm sure we'll see video and audio of it later today. Here's her tweet. Come again, Joe Biden speaking at a women's conference to boost reach out to women, just singled out Bob Packwood as the kind of Republican he misses. And for those who are too young to remember, Bob Packwood was a liberal Republican from Oregon who had to resign because he was a serial sexual harasser of women.
Yep. But he was a moderate Republican. So that makes it okay. A moderate Republican sexual harasser is what Biden likes. So take these in order. The Shylock one, our colleague Charlie Cook said, you know, pretty well, look, it's an archaic term. It's a not terribly sensitive term. But I don't think anyone would legitimately conclude based upon this that Joe Biden is an anti-Semite. And no one really should, Greg. Joe Biden is an idiot. He's not a hateful idiot, you know. So, you know, he later said it was a poor word choice and things like that. Now, we on the right have a legitimate point to say that if a Republican state lawmaker you've never heard of says something like this, then, you know, MSNBC will run round the clock coverage and it'll be full battle stations for a whole week. But it's not really, again, a dumb word choice doesn't necessarily point to malice in the heart of the speaker. And I think there is a danger that we on the right, trying to give the left a taste of their own medicine, can end up kind of facilitating this culture of perpetual outrage. And on the Orient, yeah, again, that's a really kind of archaic term. You don't hear it used very much very often, and there are folks who do get offended by it. Again, I have a tough time believing that Joe Biden is a you know, hateful or biased person. He's just an ignorant clod, and you know, give him credit for that. But then the third one about, you know, here's the thing, Packwood. Like, again, it's fascinating that the first thing that comes to Joe Biden's mind when he thinks of Bob Packwood is probably squirrels. No, it's probably, you know, his moderation. But when most people hear the name Bob Packwood, they think sexual harassment. That was, you know, it was a very, you know, big scandal at the time. And the idea that, you know, oh, that's the kind of Republican we need anymore. And just say it at a women's forum was really quite stunning. So there you go, Joe Biden being Joe Biden. It does, the problem is, if saying something stupid is going to have extremely big consequences for a public figure, then you got to judge them all equally. And you can't have somebody like Biden where they're just kind of forgive for it, or Pelosi for that matter, or Debbie Wasserman Schultz, or any one of these other, Harry Reid, you know, the tourists stink, and Romney hasn't paid taxes in 10 years and things like that. There should be a uniform measuring stick instead of only one group of people, i.e. Republicans, paying a severe price for saying something that either comes out wrong or is archaic in language or uncomfortable, or even if it's, you know, insensitive or controversial. Do we want to live in a world in which saying something controversial can cost you your job? And I think we don't really want to reach that point. So anyway, that's my take on it. I can forgive some of this. Having said that, it really has been a classic week for Biden.
It certainly has. And Jim, it was a good week for the Scottish accent. Not a great week in the build up to ISIS necessarily, but we'll see what happens next week. Talk to you then.
Aye, laddie. The day is mine.
Jim, we'll talk to you Monday.
See you Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to join us again on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.